Welcome to the Master Builders Podcast, the podcast made by Master Builders for Master Builders. Today we speak with Sean Schmidtke, National Director for Industrial Relations for Master Builders Australia. Today's podcast is the first of two podcasts where I interview Sean about industrial relations and a whole lot of things that you need to be aware of. The Australian Building and Construction Commission, the Fair Work Ombudsman, and enterprise bargaining. It sounds like a lot to get our heads around. Fortunately, Sean's here.
We're joined by Mr. Sean Schmidtke, the IR guru. Thank you for joining us. It's lovely to have you here.
Thanks for having me back on the show, Max.
Look, you're welcome. It's been a long time since we've spoken. It's good to have you here. Government made some changes to IR law in 2022. What was the biggest change?
Well, Max, the biggest change really was the abolition of the Australian Building and Construction Commission. There were a raft of changes in the legislation put through in late 2022, but that was the biggest one.
Right, okay. So I might rewind. What is IR?
Well, anything to do with industrial relations and workplace policy in a broad sense. And look, when it comes to the industrial relations and building and construction, it's always been a very interesting and different environment compared to other workplaces. What happens in this industry doesn't happen in any other industry. The types of conduct and practices that we see on site don't happen in any other workplace. Mm-hmm. Hence why Master Builders has always been right behind a dedicated industrial relations specialist regulator mm-hmm. who understands our industry, understands the practices that happen, and understands the problems that our members face each and every day. That regulator in the past has been the ABCC. It's been around for about 26 years in various iterations, and it's now been abolished as a result of this change late last year.
I know that there'll be a lot of people listening to this who will understand what you're saying, but I also know that there'll be a lot of people that just won't quite grasp it because it is complicated and it is different. So I guess, what is it about the construction industry that makes IR different and special, or the industrial relations in this area different to, say, the standard office job?
Well, it's all about the way that we perform work in building and construction and the way it's programmed and phased. We've all heard of industrial action through the form of a interrupted concrete pour. That could be a 10-minute bit of industrial action with a very significant cost that could take 2 or 3 days to rectify, push a job back by 2 or 3 days. That's just one example of what makes our industry slightly different. It's very, very susceptible because of the nature of the work we do to industrial action and disruption. And therefore, we need to make certain that we can avoid those types of practices. So if anything, it's an industry that lends itself to being disrupted on a regular basis.
I think that's a really interesting point. So it's the disruption to our workflows and the delivering of the work we do that really makes industrial relations an important. And I guess, so ideally what we're looking for is to, it's not that we don't want to talk about things, it's just there's a time and a place, and we don't think the time is in the middle of something like a concrete pour, which is absolutely time critical.
Bingo, exactly right. And then, of course, you've got client pressures, you've got liquidated damages if you don't get projects up on time. You've got the delays caused to all of your various types of subbies that might be programmed to come on site at different phases. They all have to be pushed back. Hugely expensive if you interrupt any phase of construction. So you're right. It's not about saying, no, we don't want to talk. You're right. It's not about saying no to unions. We like unions. We need to engage with employees, and we need to make sure we've got productive, consultative, and a very high-performing workforces. But at the end of the day, because of the history of the sector and the way we perform work, that's not, regrettably, the way it's always gone. Hence, we need regulators like the ABCC.
You're listening to the Master Builders Podcast, by Master Builders, for Master Builders.
So to get a picture of it, how does this, I mean, the industry scales all the way from people building sheds all the way through to people building, I mean, massive buildings and huge pieces of infrastructure. Where does the industrial relations we're talking about sort of start and finish?
Yep, good question. So there's three ways or three areas of the sector to look at industrial relations. One's the residential sector. They tend to be, well, you know, smaller jobs spread all throughout various geographic areas of the country. That's an area which traditionally is not subject to the normal argy-bargy you see in other parts of the sector for a whole raft of reasons. Then you have the commercial construction sector. This tends to be capital city projects or larger projects with quite significant value or quite large in terms of their length of time or the amount invested. That's where you tend to get a lot of the day-to-day troubles in the industry, and that's the sort of part of the sector where the ABCC focused. Then you have civil construction, the big freeway projects and things like that, or the ports or the tunnels. Again, they're also subject to a degree of disruption and delay. However, in that part of the industry, you have an even mix of coverage between the CFMEU and the Australian Workers Union, the AWU. So the CFMEU is concentrated really in the commercial construction sector. That's where most of its attention is, and that's where most of the action takes place.
Right. So, I mean, I think the general population has heard about the ABCC. I mean, goodness me, I think now there's been a number of elections where it has been a very prominent conversation. What does ABCC stand for?
Well, contrary to the bumper stickers you see, it stands for the Australian Building and Construction Commission. And this is a dedicated regulator that was established to deal with those particular problems that we find in building and construction. It was a regulator that had a specific set of industrial relations law and had specific powers to target the types of problems that we see in the sector that aren't seen anywhere else. One of the common examples, for example, is where you see blockades or people disrupting the entrance to a building site. Under normal industrial law, there's nothing that can be done about that. That's called a picket, whereas the ABCC had powers to actually target and stop and prosecute people if they were doing the wrong thing and blocking entry to a site. So it's different, for example, if you blocked entry to an office for a few hours with the union, the damage and delay that's going to cause is nowhere near the amount as if you blocked a construction site for half a day, hence why the ABCC was dedicated to building and construction. It understood the common practices and types of conduct we see in our sector, and it had specific powers and laws to deal with those problems quickly and effectively.
So the ABCC, its only job was to stop disruption to building sites?
Its job was very broad. It had a remit of ensuring that the rule of law was upheld on building and construction sites so that people weren't doing the wrong thing or weren't encouraged or incentivized to do the wrong thing. It was there to make sure that work practices were productive and that that all sorts of work on site, restrictive work practices that we've commonly seen in the past, didn't occur. So for example, there were, prior to the ABCC, it was very common to see clauses in enterprise agreements that said, you must have only union members on site. And the ABCC said, well, that's a breach of freedom of association laws, which says you can or can't be a member of a union. It's up to you to make a free decision. So part of their remit was to uphold freedom of association on construction sites. Mm. There was also laws that talk about right of entry for unions. And again, historically, it's been not uncommon for builders to agree with unions to say, look, don't worry about those entry laws. You can just come on in whenever you like, and we'll just pretend they don't exist. So again, the ABCC was there to make sure that everybody followed the law and did the right thing. There's also been a predisposition of the sector in the past to put into enterprise agreements all sorts of unproductive practices. For example, one-off, all-off. So if you had one particular type of worker who couldn't work on site or was stood down or for whatever reason, then everybody would stop work. There were clauses in enterprise agreements that said you must employ particular people nominated by the union or only employ people who were nominated by the union. There were certain clauses in awards that said before you use particular subcontractors, you must seek the permission of the union. And if the union said no, then you weren't allowed to use them. That was lawful in the past. And the ABCC was there to make sure that those type of practices didn't occur, that everybody stuck to the law, everybody played by the rules.
Now, I mean, I think I've heard of the ABCC also taking action against builders. Did that happen as well, or am I imagining that?
Well, no, that absolutely happened. So the thing about workplace law is it applies to everyone. There's no one law for unions, one law for workers, one law for employers. There's one set of laws, it's called the Fair Work Act, and their job was to prosecute breaches of the Fair Work Act. So they had in the past prosecuted large builders for using subcontractors that were dictated by the union. In fact, there was a few cases where large builders were prosecuted because they literally told subbies, we can't use you because we've been told we're not allowed to use you on our jobs. So that was a breach of freedom of association laws. There's also been breaches of underpayments or breaches of minimum wage laws that were discovered and prosecuted by the ABCC. So workplace laws are workplace laws. The ABCC was there to uphold that law without fear or favour, regardless of who broke it.
Excellent. Thank you. I think that covers off a whole bunch of background that I think, you know, depending on where you sit in the industry, will be super important.
You're listening to the Master Builders Podcast, by Master Builders, for Master Builders.
We know there's been changes to the industrial relation laws in 2022. What should I know about?
Well, the biggest one is, firstly, the abolition of the ABCC. So that regulator that was highly important to the building construction is now gone. It's now been replaced with the Fair Work Ombudsman. And all of those practices that I talked about just moments ago will now return back to site. There will no longer be a dedicated industrial relations watchdog to make sure that everybody in building construction is complying with the law. Instead, we're going to be lumped in with the generic Fair Work Ombudsman. So that's really the main change.
So why can't the Fair Work Ombudsman deal with this? Like, why can't they strap on some high vis and some big boots and get amongst it?
Well, they could, but we don't necessarily think that they will. So the thing about the Fair Work Ombudsman, and I don't want to sound critical of them unnecessarily because we support the Fair Work Ombudsman, but they are a generic regulator to look after all workplaces. Replacing the ABCC with the Fair Work Ombudsman is, and I can only explain it this way, akin to replacing a specialist high-powered latest fire truck with a Mr. Whippy van. I mean, they look the same, they both have flashing lights, they both make a noise to let you know that they're coming along. But at the end of the day, the latest model fire engine has got the specialist training, it's got the specialist equipment, and it knows exactly what it needs to do to get to the nub of the problem quickly. The Fair Work Ombudsman has to look after all workplaces, not just building and construction. And, you know, I mean, if something's on fire, you need to get a firefighter there with a hose and some water and put it out quickly. There's no point having somebody come along with a couple of handfuls of soft serve and, you know, lob a bit of sprinkles towards it and hope that it's going to work. So that is the major difference. It is a specialist dedicated regulator versus a generic regulator. The Fair Work Ombudsman also does not have the same power that the ABCC had. It is not as responsive as the ABCC, and it's not actually required to do anything. So if you ring the Fair Work Ombudsman, they're not actually obliged by law to actually come and help, whereas the ABCC was obliged by law to come and help.
Right. I've got to say that doesn't sound overly positive for the building industry. So if I'm on the ground and I'm having issues and all of a sudden I decided, this ice cream man's probably not the person I need. I probably need the firefighter. What do I do now?
Well, look, we encourage people to always contact the Fair Work Ombudsman because as much as they might not have the power, the resources or the experience, there still is a general obligation to help. So even if you ring the Fair Work Ombudsman and do nothing but leave a voicemail on their after hours line or send them an email, that will assist master builders because what it does is it shows that there still are problems in the building construction industry gives the Fair Work Ombudsman a good understanding exactly as to the level of those problems. So we encourage people to still contact the Fair Work Ombudsman. And look, it's early days. I may well be very pessimistic. Let's hope that they do get themselves into a position where they're far more responsive to the needs of the industry. However, we just don't necessarily think that they will be. So number one, ring the Fair Work Ombudsman, but of course, number two, ring Master Builders. Your local, state and territory Master Builders office will always be able to help you, and you should ring them for advice as well as the Fair Work Ombudsman.
You're listening to the Master Builders podcast, by Master Builders, for Master Builders.
All right, enterprise bargaining. What's happening in this space? I thought construction was exempt. Is this correct?
So, look, there's been a lot of big changes that have been put through in terms of the enterprise bargaining laws. These are extremely complex changes, and to be honest, I could go on about these for hours and hours. The key points that you really need to know are threefold. The first is that it's no longer the case that if you are negotiating an enterprise agreement, that you actually need to agree with your workers. So it used to be the case that an EBA required agreement between the workplace or the workers and the employer. Now, if you get bogged down in bargaining and you can't agree, the Fair Work Commission will be able to make a decision to decide what the agreement's going to be and make an order to put that agreement in place. So that's the first change, is that you no longer need to actually agree to make an enterprise agreement. The second thing is that the Fair Work Commission has got a broad range of greater powers to get involved in bargaining generally and to resolve disputes as they occur. Whereas in the past, they didn't necessarily have those powers. So if the bargaining was intractable, if it had broken down, if it had stalled, well, it was really up to the parties to resolve that themselves, because, you know, you didn't have to make an EBA. It was up to you to agree. If you couldn't agree, if negotiations went nowhere, well, they went nowhere. So there was that sort of incentive there to keep negotiations going. Whereas now, if they break down, the Fair Work Commission can actually make orders to get the bargaining back on track. But not only that, they can make orders to solve any disputes between the parties. The third big change is the reintroduction of industry-wide bargaining. Now, the Fair Work Act calls this multi-employer bargaining. This is where instead of one employer at one workplace is negotiating with their own workers, mm-hmm. instead you will have unions negotiating with a number of employers, could be 10, could be 20 employers, for one enterprise agreement that will apply across all those 10 or 20 workplaces and will equally apply to all the workers employed in those workplaces. So that's a fairly significant change, and we think that that's a pretty ordinary change because it's back to the old days of one size fits all industry-wide deals. Now, building and construction has been carved out of the multi-enterprise bargaining,
mm-hmm.
But only for those people covered by the on-site award doing work covered by the on-site award itself. So if you're under the concrete award, the mobile plumbing and fire sprinklers award, or the joinery award, for example, you are not exempt, and you might get caught up in one of these multi-enterprise authorizations. So by and large, the industry is exempt, but there are key parts that could get caught up in it, and a lot of those key parts are often on big construction sites. So it's important that people are aware of these changes.
So, and maybe I should have started with this. Enterprise bargaining, it sounds like it's something big. At what point do I, as a builder, have to be thinking about enterprise bargaining? Like what size, if I'm building a house, do I need to know about this?
Okay, so you've got to think about it this way. There's four levels of different arrangements you could have in any one workplace. You have the minimum under the Fair Work Act, then you have the minimums under an award, like the on-site award, which is an industry-specific set of minimum conditions.
And they're conditions, they're pay levels?
Rates of pay, the terms and conditions of employment, those types of things, the hours of work, what allowances you get paid, when overtime kicks in, things like that. Okay. That's all set within the modern award, for a particular industry. Then on top of that, we used to have this third level of enterprise bargaining, which is where the award didn't necessarily work for your business. So you and your employees would sit down voluntarily and come up with a different arrangement, which is different to the award, that suited your particular enterprise. So that was bargaining at the enterprise level. And subject to that agreement meeting the minimum conditions and exceeding the minimum conditions under the award, then the law used to say that's fine. You can have one of those agreements and put it in place.
And that's a scalability thing, right? So so when you're usually hitting that scale, it's because the workforce you're employing is of such a size that negotiation is presumed to be fair and balanced. Is that correct?
Not necessarily. Look, you could have an enterprise agreement with 2 employees if you wanted to.
Right.
Or you could have one with 500 employees. Like, it really doesn't make a difference. Some workplaces, some big companies, would actually have different enterprise agreements that apply to different parts of their business. So you might have, for example, the off-site work, you might have the on-site work, you might have testing and all sorts of other types of work that you do. You have a different agreement applying to that part of the business. So it's not dependent really on the size. It's more dependent on whether or not the award works for your circumstances and the type of work you're doing.
And it's not really that strange, is it? Because, just looking at this, I go, oh, right, you know, the award around carpentry sits at a particular level, but in truth, there's probably not a carpenter on site in Australia who's being paid the award for carpentry.
Yeah, so you've got to make the distinction between being paid the award rate and having an award applicable to you. So just because you're covered by an award, in our industry, it doesn't mean that you actually get paid the award rate. In fact, only 2-4% of people in our industry get paid the award rate of pay. Most people get paid well above the award rates, generally double the amount that they get under the minimum in the award. You don't need an enterprise agreement for that, and often that's not the focus. The focus is more about the practical conditions. So if you have a clause in an award that says, look, you need to make sure every morning you go to, you know, a job X and start here and clock in there and blah, blah, blah before you do Y, that might not be suitable for a business that's constantly moving around its job locations and things like that. So instead, you would come up with an agreement that would say, instead of taking the award at stock standard one size fits all approach, we've got a different approach, which the workers agree to, the employer agrees to that, and subject to it meeting the minimum under the law, it could get rubber stamped by the Fair Work Commission, and off we go.
Right, and so it's not a tool where all of a sudden you can decide to employ a group of people below the award wage.
No, absolutely not. The minimum condition under the Fair Work Act is that the enterprise agreement, before it could get approved, must be better off overall. Now, there's been problems with that in the past. Some of the more recent changes have attempted to fix that. But I suppose when it comes to multi enterprise bargaining, we've now got that fourth level above that, where you have like an EBA, except instead of the employer and the employees voluntarily negotiating it, you can actually be forced into something that's negotiated for another workplace and captured by that agreement. So you'd have one EBA applying to 10 workplaces, 10 different employers, 10 different groups of workers. And you don't have a choice as to when you want to negotiate. If you want to negotiate, even your workers don't have that choice. That's the concern about this fourth level of multi-enterprise bargaining.
How do you do that? So if I'm an employer, and this is a possibility in my workplace, you know, how am I expecting to engage with this, and what do I need to make sure I'm doing it in a way where I'm getting a fair outcome?
Well, Max, in the first instance, this is why it's good that most of building construction has been carved out from this multi-enterprise changes, number one. But number two, if you are caught by one of these attempted agreements, then you'll know about it because the union will generally send you a letter to say, we're going to start bargaining for a multi-enterprise agreement and we want you to be included. And if at that point you get correspondence to that effect, you need to go off and ring Master Builders straight away. Speak to somebody there to get advice specific to your situation, because it will be different. You might have an EBA in place at the moment. You might have started to negotiate an EBA and not finished it. You might have had an EBA which has passed its normal expiry date. Again, these changes from last year all contain different rules, different approaches, depending on what situation you're in. So just ring your local MBA and get some assistance. But hopefully, you won't be caught by one in the first place for most of our members.
You're listening to the Master Builders Podcast, by Master Builders, for Master Builders.
I personally found it really good to get to talk to Sean about industrial relations. it's evident that this is really complicated space, and it's amazing getting the opportunity to speak with someone who really knows the ins and outs and all the complexities of it. And I look forward to speaking with Sean for part two of this podcast on other changes related to industrial relations.
Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Max Rafferty, and until next time, stay safe.